Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. As thousands of Lebanese defied a ban and demonstrated in the street today, the Lebanese prime minister announced his government's resignation. We'll have more from that region later in the program, but first, another big corporate merger is in the works here. Federated Department Stores, which runs Macy's and Bloomingdale's, will take over May Department Stores, known for Marshall Field's and Lord & Taylor chains. The combined company would form a retailing giant with more than 950 stores in 49 states, an $11 billion deal that's expected to result in store closings and job cuts, and may also mean the end of the line for some well-known regional stores, such as Filene's, a favorite here in Boston. Here in our business reporter Mark Mills joins us in the studio to talk about it. And Mark, first, tell us more about the players. This is a merger that's been talked about a lot in the past few years.
These companies have been talking for about 2.5 years, off and on, Robin. Federated, based in Cincinnati, owns Macy's and Bloomingdale's. They operate 458 stores. And they've acquired other chains in recent years and converted those stores to the Macy's brand. And Federated is taking over May Department Stores. They're headquartered in St. Louis, some 490 department stores, and some very well-known chains, including Lord & Taylor, Marshall Field's, Hex, Kaufman's, and Filene's. They also operate some 700 specialty shops, including David's Bridal Wear and After Hours Formal Wear.
And 11 Priscilla of Boston stores
as well. All right, let's get Priscilla in there.
Right. But why merge now? What are the companies saying? And what does it, if anything, have to do with Walmart? Because everything seems to.
Well, every retailer operates in the shadow of the 800-pound gorilla, Walmart. But retail analysts say the department stores are targeting more upscale shoppers as moderate-income consumers use alternatives such as Walmart and Target and Kohl's. By combining, these companies feel they can create cost savings, increase their buying power in dealing with suppliers, implement nationwide advertising campaigns, which are more efficient than many regional buys for individual brands. The companies, in fact, said today at a conference call they expect to generate $450 million in cost savings by 2007. The Federated CEO, Terry Lundgren, said in that call this morning that the combined companies will grow much faster than they would on their own. Federated says it is better at merchandising, creating an attractive environment for shoppers and having the right merchandise in the right stores based on the market demographics.
Yes, but will it also mean saving by closing stores?
Yes, it will. The companies say there is not a lot of geographic overlap between Federated and May, but there are about 100 malls which have both a Federated and a May store as anchor tenants. Analysts expect weaker stores will be closed, and this could result in thousands of jobs being cut. Some stores may be sold off to other chains, such as Nordstrom's.
So when I hear thousands of jobs cut, I'm thinking those are people who won't be consumers because they've just lost jobs. But are the companies thinking that overall this will be good for consumers?
Well, yes, it should be a plus. Federated is a better-run company. So if you shop at a May store now, you may see an improvement in the merchandise and the shopping experience at that store. In some areas, people may lose a store that they're patronizing, or it may be sold off to another chain. But overall, the changes going on in retail these days seem to be pretty good for consumers. There's more options to fit your own tastes and budget.
Except, again, of course, if you are one of those consumers who's also a worker who loses your job in this merger, or one of the consumers that is pointed up in a report today. Let's just take a quick other look at the economy, because it affects this story. Personal incomes fell by 2.3% in January. That's the sharpest fall in a decade. Consumer spending was flat. So what is the pulse on the economy?
Well, these numbers are skewed a little bit, especially the income number, Robin, because these are month-to-month comparisons. So when we look at January to see whether it grew or declined, we compare it to December. In December, Microsoft issued $30 billion in dividends, a special one-time dividend to their shareholders, and that was big enough to literally skew the December figures. And so then when January comes out and compares to December, it gets all messed up by the comparison to that one-time event.
Right.
If you look at both months, in both cases, incomes were up modestly in both months if you kind of take out the one-time event. Spending is slowing a little bit. Home sales were down as well last month. There's a sense of the economy slowing a little bit in here. At the same time that interest rates are going up from the Federal Reserve and inflation is showing a little teeth. So right now, it's not a dangerous combination, but if those were to go to more extreme levels, where you have sort of a stagnating economy and an inflationary higher rate environment, We might be talking some months down the road a little more seriously about all this. It may not get there, but it's a concern.
Okay. And meanwhile, while we have you also today, former WorldCom chief Bernard Ebers might take the stand in his own defense. He's on trial for $11 billion in fraud. We heard this is a risky strategy to take the stand.
Well, it is. And in fact, Bernie Ebers did take the stand today in what I call the Jimmy the Dunce defense. I mean, he's basically saying, I didn't know what those tricky accounting people were up to. They pulled the wool over my eyes. You got the wrong guy. It is a risk to do it. It's a sign, though, I think, that the prosecution put up a strong case and that he needs to try to rebut it. It's a risk to not testify by having his critics testifying against him and convicting him. So he's taking the stand to try to save his situation at this point.
Right. And a reminder, WorldCom was driven into the largest bankruptcy in U.S. history when that fraud was revealed in 2002. It's since reemerged under the name MCI, Inc. Here now, business reporter Mark Mills, you have us up to date. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
According to recent studies, the median age that girls begin drinking is now 13. 40% of girls in college binge drink. There are thousands of websites that feature unconscious, drunken girls with men pawing them, or worse. These and other statistics appear in Corin Zilkus's new memoir, but the most damning information about drinking and girls is her own story.
I will not miss the memories that were carved out of me. When my father carried me in his arms through the sliding glass doors, my head lolling the way it used to when I was the little girl who he carried to bed. When a friend, being interviewed by the doctor treating me, had to answer vodka, which is like a curse word in the fact that we exploit it in private but don't dare utter it in the presence of adults. When a row of people looked up from their laps because the scene of a girl, dead drunk at 16, momentarily distracted them from their midnight emergencies.
Corin was an A student from a loving, intact family in Bolton, Massachusetts, who began drinking at 13, quit at the age of 23 after 4 alcohol-soaked years at Syracuse University. Her new memoir is called Smashed, Story of a Drunken Girlhood, and she joins us in the studio. Welcome, Corin.
Thank you.
And what a book.
Thank you.
You write, you don't remember your first kiss, but you remember your first drink in tender detail. What age were you when you started drinking?
I was 13 when I had my first drink.
Yeah, from a girlfriend at her parents'
yep,
cottage.
Yep, her parents. It was after school. Her parents weren't home, and she pulled out a bottle of Southern Comfort from her liquor cabinet.
What did it feel like?
It was gross. The taste was revolting, but I think I went into it thinking that it would help me come out of my shell and shed my inhibitions.
You were shy.
I was a very shy girl.
Yeah. And then what happened? When did it go from there to, you know, the horrendous nights of sleeping in your vomit and not knowing what you'd done? Right. What was the transition?
It was a slow evolution. I think in high school, even still, I wasn't drinking all that often. It was maybe one or two nights out of the month my friends and I got our hands on liquor. But by and large, it wasn't until I got to college where it was this excessive drinking, this drinking to get absolutely obliterated began.
Yeah, but you are skipping over a chapter.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, you had two incidents that you described when you were younger, one in which a friend of yours almost dies. But still. You don't stop. What's compelling you forward at this point?
I think as girls and as women, we're socialized to put a lot of stock in our female friendships and in being social beings. And all of my friends when I was a teenager and when I was in high school were looking for opportunities to drink. So I think I was intensely afraid of being left alone. And it was that was scarier than any consequence that could have come from drinking.
And yet, even though you're caught, you're grounded, there becomes your first blackout shortly after. Mm-hmm. Would you do me a favor? I want you to read this paragraph. It's on page 93.
Okay.
This is when you're reconstructing what happened that night.
They tried to give me a shower to clean off the combination of liquor, vomit, dirt, and leaves that was adhered to me. I'll never know if I was fully naked or if they left my underthings on because I am too embarrassed to ask. Nor will I know if Alan was there while they did it, though I don't know how they could have held me under the showerhead without his strength. Afterward, they must have put me back into the sweatpants because they are there in the plastic bag that my dad carried home from the hospital, and they are all but crusted with vomit. My mom will wash them and insist that I return them in a most undignified moment to the girl at school on Monday morning.
You would think that spending time in the hospital, having your stomach pumped.
One would think. And for a while, I was scared straight. It lasted for a couple of months. But you have to bear in mind that I didn't remember any of this. So it was hard to bear it in mind. I think maybe my friends were frightened because they were there and they were conscious and they were present for it, whereby I missed the whole thing because it happened during a blackout. Mm. And most of the kids that I knew were drinking. And they weren't the bad kids. They were the president of the student council and the senior class president. I mean, they were the captains of the sports teams, and they were smart kids, and they were kids who went to Ivy League universities. I think a lot of us have this idea of what the drinking girl looks like, and a lot of us have seen that old Jeff Richards Saturday Night Live skit, that girl who's overweight and uncontrolled, and she's sloppy, and she's masculine, and it's not. It's anyone's daughter.
Yeah. And you get to college, and you don't even have to hide it anymore.
Absolutely. I think you get to college, and parents and teachers and administrators expect that you're going to be drinking underage and accept that you're going to be drinking to excess.
How are you keeping up at school?
It's miraculous, but I did. I was an A student. I was making the dean's list every semester, and I graduated with honors.
I can't believe, though, how many times you seem to try to get help. You would go into a nurse and you'd be sobbing,
right,
and she'd say to you, "That's your menstrual cycle talking," when in fact you were probably having a breakdown.
I know. Well, here was the thing. Halfway through college, all of a sudden I wasn't getting drunk and feeling happy and feeling like the life of the party. I was getting drunk and feeling really depressed or sobbing hysterically or feeling really angry. You know, my mom thought I had a problem with depression. She could see that I was down and I felt depressed, but it didn't occur to any of us that drinking at the rate I was drinking can bring out symptoms that look like depression.
I keep going back to an image that you left me with. You smell, you vomit, cigarette smoke, lack of hygiene from just being up 24 hours. Describe one of those nights.
Yeah, we looked like the walking dead half the time, my friends and I. I remember one night, like, throwing up in my sheets and throwing up on my teddy bear. I was still sleeping with a teddy bear. I was still a little girl. But I was, you know, making a mess of myself.
You know, and I sit here and I look at you, and you're beautiful. You look a little like Winona Ryder. Did people tell you that?
Yeah, everyone's been telling me that lately.
And you're a tiny thing, 5'2",
yeah.
Do I hear?
Yeah.
What was so bad that you hated about yourself? What was it? Because you write that you felt like you must be disfigured.
Yeah, I mean, it was just an element of self-loathing, and I think self-doubt that is really common. People probably looked at me and thought I had it made, but it was the way that I felt about myself, and I thought I was just a waste of breath.
Well, in college, you started acting out on that feeling, attacking people, stealing things, as you write, that rageful behavior felt safe as long as you were in college. But then you graduated, moved to New York City. Suddenly, you find yourself waking in a strange apartment with two strange men rather than frat boys, and the danger that's been there all along is revealed to you. Corin, stay right there. When we come back, we want to talk more about how you stopped drinking, what you want to say to young girls to keep them from starting, how you feel about the industry that seduces them. More from Corin Zilkus, author of the book Smashed, when we come back. Also, the latest from Lebanon. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, continuing our conversation with 24-year-old Corin Zilkus, whose new memoir, Smashed, tells of her 10-year drinking binge, starting at the age of 13. She stopped only after a night out in New York City, when she woke up in a strange apartment with two strange men. She's pretty sure they didn't have sexual relations, but Corin, I want to ask, in college you woke up in someone's bed, so this happened once before.
Right.
Well, you don't know what
happened.
Where
I don't know what happened. Yeah.
Have you ever asked him what happened?
No. I didn't want to know what happened. And I made a point almost immediately after I woke up in this boy's fraternity house to forget it almost right away. I just wanted to forget it and move on and not think about it. Right. And I did for a long, long time.
And then post-college, as we were saying, you go to New York, these two men pick up you and your girlfriend, and You all tumble into a bed. But it's astonishing how little sex you do have throughout these 9 years. The relationship was with the alcohol.
It was. I mean, my relationship with alcohol made me feel better than any man could have made me feel at that point in time. And I did always just have a deep fear of intimacy, and I was really intimidated by men.
So after this experience where you wake up with strangers in a strange apartment, then you decide you want to change. How hard was that?
It was hard in the sense, at first I thought, okay, I'm going to drink moderately and responsibly, which is hard. One night I was out with my boyfriend and I'd had two beers and I was drunk and acting like an idiot and being mean when it was, the last thing that I meant or wanted to do. So after that I realized, you know, it's going to be hard for me to find that moderate point. It's always so, haven't had a drink in over a year since then, and it's been nice to stand on my own 2 feet and not rely on drinking.
But, you know, a lot of people who have struggled to stop drinking would say, how did you do that at the age of 23?
Yep.
How do you just stop?
I think I was lucky in the sense that when I decided this is it, no more, I could just stop. But there are people who are genetically predisposed to this disease, and it's going to be harder to give up. But I think the thing that was hard was, after I stopped drinking, I was confronted with all of the things I'd been using alcohol as an escape from. So I felt really awkward again. I felt really shy. It thrust me right back into that second adolescence. So that was hard.
Yeah.
But I think writing helped. And I think writing, in a lot of ways, was a substitute for drinking. And it helped to find a sense of self and value outside of being a girl who's fun to get drunk with.
You said you had a fear of intimacy, but in reading this book, you were far more intimate with complete strangers than most people would be, sleeping on top of people, sharing bottles till 4 or 5 in the morning.
Right.
Where are those people?
All of those friendships and relationships sort of burnt out and died hard long before I ever quit drinking.
That's very sad. How old are you now?
24.
It's very sad.
I know, and I do feel like I wish I came out of college with these lasting friendships. And by and large, people have slowly started coming back.
But how do the people feel whose story you've told? I mean, you've told
on
people.
I have told on people, but I do think and I do hope that it comes through in the book that I'm not out to indict anyone else, and that I hope I am harder on myself than anyone else. So on the edge of my seat wondering, are they going to come back? Are they going to be angry? Are they just okay? Do they keep drinking like this?
I was going to say, are they still drinking?
I don't know.
Could the amount of alcohol that you drink is astonishing.
I know.
You almost died a couple of times.
Yeah.
Could anyone still be doing that?
I hope for them that they're not.
Yeah. You've said it's not about them. You're not angry at them. You're more trying to get at your own feelings,
right.
But you are very angry at the alcohol industry.
I am angry at the alcohol industry because there has been all of this really amazing and terrifying research coming out of Georgetown University, especially out of the Center for Alcohol Marketing and Youth. Kids see more alcohol ads than adults who are age 21 and older do, and girls see more than boys. And there are ads for alcohol running on the WB during the Gilmore Girls and Seventh Heaven. I mean, these are shows that kids watch. That makes me angry.
The guy who has set up a cottage industry taping girls at spring break who will show their breasts, he makes you angry?
He makes me angry. Joe Francis of Girls Gone Wild makes me really angry. There are camera crews going down to spring break to clubs and bars and places where they know girls are going to be drinking. And I think there is something really predatory about that.
Are you angry at the girls?
The girls themselves? I could not possibly, because I'm one of them. And I think statistically there are so many of us. I mean, this is a cultural phenomenon at this point, and we need to do something about it as a society.
But shouldn't they take some responsibility? You did.
But I think it's always been hard to admit that you're a woman who's had problems with alcohol, because that stigma is age old, that it opens up the door to, if you're a drinking woman, you must be promiscuous and you must be lacking in self-control. So it's hard to admit, I think.
I want to ask you about your parents.
Yeah.
You dedicate the book to your mom. Mm-hmm. You thank both of your parents at the end for being your oxygen tent, mm-hmm. helping you while you wrote this book. But I couldn't help but ask myself, where were they when your dad at one point goes, just to make sure you've fallen asleep at a house, he leaves a note on your car saying, when you wake up, please come home.
Right.
Why didn't he go in there and get you?
To be fair, there were a lot of things that I kept from them. Also, I think my parents were really afraid of making alcohol the forbidden fruit. They wanted me to have a responsible relationship with drinking. But
even when you were trying to quit at one point, your father gave you as a Christmas present a bottle of Malibu, is it?
I don't even know what that is. Malibu rum. It is disgusting. It's this sugary rum, and it was horrible. But I think they're not immune, and drinking's a huge part of our culture, and I think... I don't know.
Could anything have stopped you when you were 13, 14 years old?
That's the question.
That compulsion to...
Having my first drink when I was 13, I probably ran into more problems that researchers say you're less likely to run into if you wait until you're 18.
And yet you write 13 is the median age that girls are drinking now.
That's what they say.
How do you keep this story? How do you keep it the cautionary tale I know you intended? I mean, this is disgusting. Some of the stuff you did was just disgusting.
I know.
How do you keep it that way, though, and don't keep it from, oh, I'm just going to be just like her. I'm going to drink for 9 years and have a great story to tell. Or
I know. It's hard because I don't think anyone's going to look at Smash and say, man, this looks like fun. I mean, for the most part, there are some things in here that are disgusting and sad and some parts that are hard to read, I'm told. And so I do hope that... it'll dissuade younger readers, perhaps, or maybe make college girls who are still out there drinking like this think even for just a second.
Mm. Corin Zelkis, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Corin Zelkis is author of the book Smashed. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Lebanese Prime Minister Omar Karami has announced his government's resignation during a session of parliament as thousands of Lebanese defied a ban on demonstrations and gathered outside parliament to demand that Syria, the dictatorship next door, remove its troops from their country. Well, joining us on the line from Beirut is Reuters news correspondent Nadim Lakhti. And Nadim, what exactly is the prime minister saying? Because we'd heard reports that earlier today, Karami had asked the legislature to renew its confidence in his cabinet. So what is he saying?
Yeah, basically, when the parliament session reconvened, he stunned everyone by announcing that after what he heard in the morning session from attacks on him personally and on the government, he said that out of concern that the government does not become an obstacle to the good of the country, I announced the resignation of the government I had the honor to lead. That led to an immediate outburst of applause from opposition MPs and from thousands of protesters who had, as you said, defied the ban on protests to take to a square near Parliament to demand his resignation.
We should point out that the protesters, who we understand number about 25,000 at this point, had already gathered there, and that the protests were 2 weeks after the assassination of the predecessor to the current prime minister, Rafiq Hariri. How did the protesters react to news that the current government had resigned?
Basically, there were two giant screens put up by the opposition at Martyrs Square, where the protesters had gathered, and they were watching Karami's speech to Parliament live. The second he announced his resignation, the whole crowd burst into cheers and into clapping, and basically they were ecstatic. They were waving Lebanese flags, they were shouting that they want Syria out, and they were also saying that President Emil Lahoud, who's also backed by Syria, should be next to quit.
Well, when Prime Minister Omar Karimi said that he was being attacked in the parliament, what were they saying? What were parliament members saying?
Several MPs from the opposition during morning addressed the parliament, and they basically said if the government didn't know or didn't carry out the killing of ex-Prime Minister Rafiq al-Hariri, at least they are partially responsible because they are in charge of the country. They are in charge of the country, and they are also in charge of security in the country. So they had at least partially to be blamed. They also accused the government of seeking to block the investigation into the murder. The opposition MPs also criticized Karami for saying last week in an interview to Reuters that he feared for the stability of Lebanon if the Syrian troops left quickly or abruptly, and he also warned that the Lebanese army might be fragile and might collapse into sectarian splits like it did during the Lebanese civil war. Mm. So all in all, it wasn't a good day at the office for Mr. Karami.
Well, and Nadeem, what happens now? There are 25,000 people in the streets. What happens now for the Lebanese government?
Constitutionally, now the Lebanese President, Emile Lahoud, should ask parliamentarians to nominate a new prime minister. As we know, the majority of the parliament are pro-Syrian. As for the opposition, well, they haven't yet, I don't think the news have yet sunk in. We've had several different statements from them. Some of the opposition leaders have pledged to continue with the protests until Syria leaves Lebanon. Others, like the main figure, Walid Jumblat, said he wants to consult with his allies before deciding the next move. But he's called for calm, and he said that the people have won, but now we have to sit down and think carefully about our next step. So it's not yet clear whether the opposition would go all the way. We have to wait for the next 2 days, I think, until we get a clearer picture.
Nadeem Lakhti is a Reuters reporter based in Beirut. Nadeem, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, joining us now is Tamara Kaufman-Witty. She's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution's Saban Center for Middle East Policy in Washington. Tamara, welcome. And we know you don't have the news. What am I trying to say? The news that comes right to your desk as we do. The news wire. So when we called you with this news, your first reaction was, "Get out." Your reaction to the fact that the current prime minister in Lebanon has dissolved his government?
It certainly suggests that the public pressure and the international pressure on Syria has become so intense that there is no one left in Lebanon who's willing to carry water for them anymore. And that is a significant development. It means that if Syria wants to maintain its dominance over Lebanon and this very important conduit for its involvement in regional politics, it's going to have to do it directly, and therefore it will pay a heavy price.
Well, and Syria is at the center of a number of stories in the Middle East today. Syria, which has long been accused of being behind the insurgency in Iraq, turned over the half-brother of Saddam Hussein today. Israel is also accusing Syria of being behind the weekend Tel Aviv bombing. And now, as we're hearing, Lebanese are calling for Damascus to pull troops out of Lebanon. How much of a tinderbox is this right now?
I don't think it's a tinderbox in the sense of violence, but what all these developments do remind us of is just how important Syria is to the stability of the region and to many of the major issues that occupy the United States and the Middle East today. This half-brother of Saddam, along with 29 other senior Ba'athist officials who were turned over, had played an important role from across the Syrian border in encouraging the Iraqi insurgency. And the accusation of involvement in the suicide bombing in Israel points to the fact that Syria does still sponsor and support Palestinian terrorist organizations. So what this means is that although Syria is weak, although it's under a lot of pressure and a lot of scrutiny, it still has the ability to play a destructive role in many of the issues that concern the entire world in the Middle East right now.
Well, I was going to ask you, going back to Lebanon, where there is somewhat of a vacuum there right now, and as we said, 25,000 people, probably more at this point. in the street now, not protesting, but, expressing joy. What is your educated guess in the few seconds we have as to what happens now?
There are parliamentary elections scheduled for May, so whatever government is formed will be an interim government. It's very possible that this prime minister will be able to reconstitute a cabinet, including some members of the opposition. But in order for that to happen, he would have to agree to take on the necessity of removing Syrian interference in Lebanese politics. So these parliamentary elections in the spring will probably mark a sea change in Lebanon's politics. At least let's hope so.
And Tamar, again, just a few seconds. Syrian troops had withdrawn somewhat. Do you anticipate these 15,000 Syrian troops might come back into the area?
I don't think so, unless the demonstrations turned violent, and I think the opposition is working hard to avoid that. But we have to remember, it's not just the Syrian military that ensures Syrian control over Lebanon right now. The intelligence services are everywhere, and they have agents in just about every significant business and ministry.
Tamara Kaufman-Wittes is a research fellow at the Brookings Institution Saban Center for Middle East Policy. Tamara, thank you as always.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and now. Well, here in the U.S., residents of Wichita, Kansas are reeling from the news that a local municipal employee who was an active member of the Lutheran Church, a former Boy Scout leader, and a married father of two has been arrested for the notorious BTK murders, a string of brutal Kansas homicides dating back more than 30 years. Dennis Rader's neighbors and his former co-workers never suspected that the city worker could be responsible for up to 10 grisly deaths. BTK stands for Bind, Torture, and Kill, which was how the assailant murdered his victims. Wichita reporter Carla Eccles is covering the story for KMUW Radio. She just returned from today's press conference. And Carla, first of all, what did you find out that's new?
Well, the Wichita Police Chief Norman Williams, he was admonishing the media. He's very concerned that erroneous information is getting out, being leaked. There's a lot of speculation out there that there might be even more slayings. And so he wanted to make sure that the media is aware they are the official office and that they will be giving any updates. He also reviewed that at 12:15 on Friday, the serial killer known as BTK was arrested. He talked about him being arrested in connection with the 10 homicides that span over 31 years, as you have mentioned. He also said that Dennis Rader is currently being held in the Sedgwick County Adult Detention Facility, and he's being held on $10 million bond, one per victim.
What led them to Dennis Rader?
Well, a series of things. One reportedly was a disc that was actually connected with the church. The police were able to go to the Lutheran Church in Park City, which is a Wichita suburb, and there was a connection there with some information that was released on the disc. Also, DNA has been speculated as well. In fact, the governor of Kansas, Kathleen Sebelius, has said that that was key to the case, but the police have not confirmed that. They said that's part of the investigation, and they won't elaborate.
And by the way, did you say disc as in CD disc? Or?
Correct.
Great. Well, we understand that Rader's 26-year-old daughter may have also provided DNA that resulted in his capture.
And that has not been confirmed. That's been reported from different media outlets, but that has yet to be confirmed.
Yeah. Well, this is a man who apparently had a job measuring people's grass to make sure it wasn't too long, an inspector, a city inspector. He had access to their homes. How are people reacting to this?
Boy, there's a lot of dismay. There's shock, especially from family members, obviously, and then those that knew him who, worshiped with him at his church in Park City. But other folks in the public are relieved. They're thinking now, we feel more secure. We're so grateful that after all these years, this man has been caught.
And remind us, he had been sending letters and notes to police and news outlets over the years.
Yes, he had. In fact, jewelry, too. And it's an ongoing investigation, so I'm sure more information about that will be coming out. And by the way, it was a floppy disk that was sent to the media outlet, and that's when they were able to be able to connect to Dennis Rader.
Right. And Carla, we said that most people are saying, as people usually do, we never would have imagined. But some people in the area have been saying, well, actually, we were a little nervous about this fellow.
Mm-hmm. That is true. And in fact, neighbors, some of his neighbors are saying some of those things that they always thought there was something a little bit odd about him. And so, you know, they're not everybody in the neighborhood is surprised that he's the one. But there are others who, obviously, as I mentioned, who went to church with him, who knew him, even family members who are totally in disbelief and cannot believe that their own cousin or their son has been arrested and said to have committed these brutal crime.
Well, Carla Eccles, what happens next?
Well, actually, today or tomorrow, he'll be formally charged, and we're waiting to hear news of when that'll actually happen, but that's expected either later today or tomorrow.
Yeah. Carla Eccles is with KMUW Radio. Carla, thank you so much for filling us in on the arrest of the alleged BTK murderer. Most of Kansas is breathing a sigh of relief.
Oh, yes, that's so true, and thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Many say that battles of the future will be fought over water. Getting potable water to population centers has been a challenge since the days of the Roman Empire. One such challenge was overcome in the early part of the last century, in the late 1930s, when four towns in the Swift River Valley in Massachusetts were destroyed, leveled, and burnt to the ground, displacing 2,500 residents, in order to build the Quabbin Reservoir, which provides water primarily to Greater Boston, some 65 miles away. Dana, Massachusetts, once one of the towns destroyed to make way for the Quabbin. Sean Cole of WBUR's Inside Out documentary unit met some of the residents of this former town at their annual summer reunion.
It's July. Hot. The bugs are out. I meet Earl Cooley at a gravel turnoff from Route 32A, where he stands like a sentry in front of a metal gate that keeps cars out of Quabbin Reservation. Once a year, the reservoir's management gives him a key to this gate, so he and other former residents of Dana, Massachusetts, can drive to the place where their town once stood.
Well, this is the reunion that we have on Dana Common. Past residents of the town and their descendants show up, and we have a get-together on the common and have a little picnic and talk over and go look at our different cellar holes where we live.
They visit cellar holes. That's their big walk down memory lane. There's really nothing to see on the way into Dana, but after about 2 miles, the road widens out onto the eeriest place I have ever seen. It's a manicured patch of green, impaled by a few trees, and surrounded by an actual traffic circle. It is a town common in the middle of the woods, an untown, a place that so clearly used to teem with people, it's as though they heard us coming and ran off into the forest to hide. But then again, I'm with the people who lived here, as well as their grown children and their kids. Earl's daughter Ann Clark calls to her little girl.
Kaylee, you gotta put out the flowers and water them.
Does it have to be empty?
Yeah, empty it all in there. They need a good watering. This is what they did with the money they raised from all these reunions. They had this granite stone engraved and put up here.
Can you read it to me?
It says, site of Dana Common, 1801 to 1938. To all those who sacrificed their homes and way of life, erected by Dana Reunion, 1996.
Apparently, the cellar hole visits happen later on in the day, but I can't wait. I trudge a short distance into the woods to try to find one on my own. There, I stumble onto Florence May Avery, Earl's sister. She's pacing back and forth, searching the ground like she's lost something.
What you looking for?
Well, that's where our house sat, over there.
Really?
But I'm trying to figure out
I remember that tree.
Her cousin Dot bursts out of a porta potty at the end of the path and ambles over.
Yeah, that's fine. No, I was just looking over this way to see. Our house was over there. Mm-hmm. I was looking to see. At one time, I could tell by the lilac bush.
So it was, is it a cellar hole that's visible? Or?
Yes, it would be visible if you could find it over there in the brush. And I'm not going over there, but that's where it is. Yeah. Well, now I can go and have my own
lunchtime.
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 Lunchtime. Where's Lois? She's waiting for her lunch.
Lunchtime is full of chatty catching up, talking about Dana, talking about things other than Dana. And all in all, it's what I expected this event would look like. But this isn't the event. This is the meal before the event. At a certain point, Earl Cooley and his sister walk over and stand behind a long card table under a roof tent.
Glad to see all your people show up here today. I'll ask my secretary if she has anything to say to start off with.
Me?
Florence is no longer Florence. She's secretary and treasurer. Earl is president. And together, they conduct a full-fledged town meeting in a place where there hasn't been a town since 1938. It's an untown meeting, complete with parliamentary procedure and one-year term limits.
Now we got to have election of officers, so we'd like to have some volunteers.
And every year, the same officers, Earl, Florence, and Vice President Vernon Vaughn, are uncontested and reelected in a landslide. Earl opens up the discussion to the floor, which in this case means asking people if they have any stories about Dana they'd like to tell.
And a lot of them say, well, I ain't got nothing to say. And then they say, oh, I thought of one, and that would start it. And the different ones would tell different stories of what they remember in the Quabbin. Once these people are gone, they're gone forever. If we can only keep them coming, that'll be history years down the road to other people of what these people thought of the Quabbin when they were there.
Mr. Betts, how about telling some of your stories from your mother?
Well, I was just thinking, Dr. Seeger,
I don't know if he delivered me or not. Would he deliver babies?
Oh, I expect he had his hand in most anything.
They talk about making May baskets, gathering maple sap, how the sharp corner on Skinner Hill got to be named Dead Man's Curve. Finally, and without much fanfare, the meeting is adjourned.
Okay, now what do we have to do?
Well, I think we've had a story time, so if anyone wants to go riding, go. Look over your old cell holes and houses and everything.
I scan the crowd, trying to see if anyone's wandering off to visit their cellar hole. In the corner of the common, an old man in a baseball cap climbs into his black pickup truck and takes off down a narrow road opposite the one we entered from. I race to my car and follow him. For 4 miles, we drive in tandem. A long way to go to look at a hole in the ground, but there's no turning back. Finally, out from between the branches above us, emerges a clear, open sky and the most beautiful, placid lake I've ever seen in Massachusetts. It looks like a storybook image of paradise, surrounded by trees and clean shoreline, hills jutting up out of the water like Loch Monsters. The road vanishes at the reservoir's edge. The truck pulls over. The man gets out and just stands there, gazing at the Quabbin.
I thought you might be coming out to see where you grew up, but I guess...
No. I come in here fishing a lot, and it hasn't changed a bit. So same old scenery here.
What's your catch?
Yes, sir. How you doing?
More people arrive. Earl Cooley's daughter Sue and her kids, Chris and Sarah. Some friends of theirs are here, too. And Kaylee, the little girl who watered the flowers in front of the monument. Swimming in the reservoir is forbidden, although motorboats are not.
And we got to pollute the water to send it to Boston anyway. Why should they have good water?
And we have a radio from Boston.
Oh.
By which she means me.
Yeah, we won't tell them what the boaters do then when they come out fishing. You don't want to know when they're out here all day.
The older kids are playing around the water's edge, threatening to push each other in. And then one of them jumps into Boston's drinking water. My underwear are all wet. Think of that, Boston, next time you turn on the tap. It's days like this when you wish you could superimpose the present onto the past, have the two coexist in such a way that the people of the Swift River Valley look up into the sky and see the dangling feet of their grandchildren above them. In a sense, everyone is still enjoying the beauty and simplicity of the valley, the richness of the river that gave them everything and that took it all away.
Visit to the former town of Dana, Massachusetts, now part of the Quavon Reservoir, the water supply for Boston, was produced by Sean Cole of WBUR's Inside Out documentary unit. For a link to the complete documentary, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.